Welcome to our podcast series on first-line treatment strategies for the management of locally advanced metastatic urothelial carcinoma in Canada. This episode, recorded at ESMO 2023, includes a presentation of the new EV-302 results by Dr. Thomas Powles from St. Bart's Cancer Centre in London, who was selected to present the data at the ESMO 2023 Congress. This is followed by a discussion with Dr. Normand Blais from the Schoom Cancer Centre in Montreal, Dr. Shrikala Shridhar from Princess Margaret Cancer Centre in Toronto, and Dr. Bernie Eigel from the BC Cancer Agency in Vancouver, who provide insight on the impact of new data presented at ESMO 2023 on the first-line management of patients with locally advanced metastatic urothelial carcinoma. The video for this podcast is available on our website and can be found in the episode description.
Hello, and thank you for selecting our super late breaking abstract today. I'm going to present EV-302. It's an open labeled randomized phase 3 study of enfortumab vedotin combined with pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy in previously untreated first line metastatic urothelial cancer, which is also known as bladder cancer. So there are approximately 200,000 deaths globally from urothelial cancer. And the prognosis of these patients is poor, very few patients with advanced disease making it to 5 years. And the median survival is been pretty stubborn at between 12 and 14 months over a number of prospective studies. Monotherapy immune checkpoint inhibition has been used in the disease with mixed results. It's used predominantly in the second line setting or the maintenance setting. The PD-L1 biomarker has been unreliable. And it's not superseded chemotherapy in the frontline setting. And indeed, two previous trials, when we look at chemotherapy and immune checkpoint inhibition together, have failed to show an overall survival benefit. So as things currently stand, maintenance of avelumab or second-line immune checkpoint inhibitors are used, but there remains a high unmet need. Enfortumab vedotin is a Nectin-4 ADC. It targets MMAE. It's a drug that's widely used in urothelial cancer. It has level 1A evidence and a response rate of about 40% in platinum refractory disease. Pembrolizumab is a PD-1 immune checkpoint inhibitor. It's also got level 1A evidence in platinum refractory urothelial cancer and is widely used in the disease. When we combine these two drugs together in the first line setting in the cisplatin ineligible patients, we show response rates of 68%. That's higher than expected, and that prompted us to launch a large prospective randomized phase 3 study comparing enfortumab vedotin with pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy, Gemcis or Gemcarbo, in first-line untreated metastatic urothelial cancer. This is an overview of the study design. The patient population is this previously untreated patients with urothelial cancer, radiologically measurable disease, eligible for platinum-based chemotherapy, EV and pembrolizumab, adequate renal function and adequate performance status. 886 patients were randomized 1-to-1 to receive pembrolizumab until progression, or Gemcis / Gemcarbo chemotherapy. Patients were permitted to have maintenance of avelumab. The dual primary endpoints were progression-free and overall survival. There was a specific statistical analysis plan, and the first plan analysis, which is the one I'm presenting today, looked at the final PFS and one of two OS analyses. This is the first of those OS analyses, and because it's positive, it becomes the final analysis. But the patient's demographics were well balanced between the two arms, with approximately 60% of patients being PD-L1 positive by CPS, 70% of patients having visceral metastasis, and 55% of patients having cisplatin-based therapy in the two arms. 33% of patients remain on enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab. Enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab was given till progression, and chemotherapy was given for 6 cycles, and that accounts for some of the imbalance between these arms. It's worthwhile noting that 21% of patients stopped EVP because of adverse event. This is the progression-free survival by a blinded independent review. You can see a 55% reduction in the risk of progression of disease with enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab. The hazard ratio is 0.45, which is highly statistically significant. Progression-free survival was 12.5 versus 6.3 months, almost a doubling in that. The curves go apart and stay apart. Here are some landmarks in 18 months. 44% of patients progression-free with fortune mapidotin and pembrolizumab. Forest plot analysis reveals broad subgroups of patients benefiting from fortune mapidotin and pembrolizumab. This includes key areas around cisplastic eligibility, PD-L1 status, and presence of visceral metastasis.
So this is the overall survival curve. You can see the risk of death has been reduced by 53% of patients. The hazard ratio is 0.47. This is highly statistically significant. The curves go apart and they stay apart. The median for the chemotherapy arm is 16 months. The tail of this curve, the median at 31 months, represents quite heavy censoring at that time. And these landmarks show 70% 18 months overall survival. Subgroup analysis for key areas includes cisplatin eligibility. The benefit from fortune mapidotin is irrespective of the choice of chemotherapy, cisplatin and carboplatin, with hazard ratios of 0.55 and 0.45 respectively. Again, the shape of the curves, the same with the curves going apart and staying apart. And the same applies for PD-L1 status. Here, the PD-L1 biomarker didn't appear to be prognostic or predictive. Forest plot analysis revealed in fortune mapidotin and pembrolizumab together, benefiting broad subgroups of patients. Again, we've seen two of those subgroups just now, but other subgroups like liver metastasis and performance status also show benefit from fortune mapidotin and pembrolizumab. Confirmed overall response rate was 68%, which was consistent with the phase 2 data, which I described at the beginning. But there was a striking CR rate of nearly 30%, 29% CR rate. This is somewhat unprecedented in this disease and is an important finding. It's also relevant that the median duration of response hasn't been reached. So we're having deep responses, and these responses are durable. Subsequent therapy revealed 59% of patients in the chemotherapy arm receiving subsequent PD-L1 inhibitors, PD-L1 inhibitors. And indeed, this is 32% of patients who received maintenance therapy, particularly maintenance avelumab. This makes the control arm competitive. It's also worthwhile noting that a high proportion of patients who progressed on EVP, the standard treatment appears to be subsequent platinum-based chemotherapy. I think this is relevant from a clinical perspective. The adverse event profile shows 56% of patients having grade 3 or 4 toxicity with fortune mapidotin and 70% of patients with chemotherapy. The chemotherapy toxicity is mainly around hematological toxicity. While with unfortunate mavidotin, we see peripheral neuropathy, and we see skin rash being prominent. There were 4 treatment-related deaths in both arms, about 1%, and these weren't consistent with any particular finding. The median number of cycles were given were 12 for EVP and only 6 for chemotherapy. EVP has treatment-related adverse events of special interest. The skin reactions at 15%, peripheral neuropathy at 7%, and hyperglycemia at 6%. There were no deaths associated with these 3 events. Special interest, adverse events of special interest with pembrolizumab were in line with expectations. In summary, EV-302 shows for the first time that we can beat platinum-based chemotherapy. It's the first time we've surpassed it in a generation from a survival perspective. For these group of patients, unfortunately, mapidotin shows a statistically significant reduction in the risk of progression and the risk of death. Median progression-free and overall survival were nearly doubled. Benefit was across broad subgroups of patients. No new safety signals seen. These results are transformative in first-line urothelial cancer, in my opinion. They support EVP as a new standard of care in first-line disease.
Hello, everyone. This is Normand Blais, live at ESMO, with the discussion today about the most recent data concerning the EV-302 study. And to start the discussion, I'm going to present my two friends and colleagues, Dr. Kala Sridhar from the Princess Margaret Hospital in Toronto, and Bernie Eigel from Vancouver in British Columbia. And maybe just to start, I'm going to ask Dr. Sridhar what she felt about the overall results of the EV-302 study.
Yes. So I think in a word, I think it was stunning. It was exciting. It defines a new first line in this disease. And we've been trying for many, many years to replace platinum in the frontline setting. So this was a, I would say, a convincing win in this setting. I think the presentation was moving and there was an applause at the end, a standing ovation. And I would argue that that was in part for the data, but also for Dr. Pals, who's been such a significant force in this disease.
So just to remind everyone that at that conference, we had had a previous release of the preliminary data because ESMO, unfortunately, had a leak in the data. So about 4 or 5 days before, we had had a preview of this very exciting data. And I was surprised. I participated in EV-302, and I thought that eventually this would lead to a positive trial, but I didn't expect to see that during the first release of the data this year. Bernie, do you have some additional comments in that regard?
Yeah, I think I was very surprised at how early the results came as well, which sort of gave us a peek that it probably would be quite a large difference between the two treatment arms when it was finally presented.
The PFS results showed a hazard ratio of 0.45, and the overall survival data showed a hazard ratio of 0.47. That's a little bit out of what we usually see. Usually, hazard ratios for overall survival are not as impressive as progression-free survival. How do we explain that? Maybe, Calla, going back to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're right. And even we saw the CheckMate data presented, and that was hazard ratio about 0.7. So this is a really significant reduction in the risk of both progression and risk of death. And I think it probably speaks to the activity of this drug and this drug combination. I mean, we saw in the previous EV-103, I think cohort K, response rates for EV Pembro are sitting up at around 65-70%. So in that ballpark, that's the first point. The second point is many of these responses are seen on the very first scan assessment, which is super early in the assessment, right? So, you know, and I think I had patients on this trial as well, and you could see it. I mean, there were great responses. So I think it just speaks to the activity of these agents in combination.
So, Calla, you're essentially saying that maybe the bigger difference is the early action, the decrease in the number of progressive disease patients, and the fact that we're not losing patients very early with this combination.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The other possible explanation, I've been thinking about this, was maintenance of Avelumab. I think before the amendment came through to allow for maintenance of Avelumab, if patients were put onto it, it was counted as a progression event. So the control arm would have had sort of earlier progression, which wasn't really progression. It was change of anti-cancer therapy or addition of anti-cancer therapy. So, and which in a sense is a good thing when we talk about later the percentage of patients who received Avelumab.
Well, I'm looking at the curves, and there's a bump in the progression at 6 months. So that might fit with your theory that Avelumab would lead to a change in PFS. But if that were the case, these patients wouldn't necessarily die, right? So you wouldn't have that similarity between PFS and OS. So it probably isn't the only explanation. But that's an interesting comment that you've made, Bernie. And I think we should have that explanation going forward, because it's an important consideration when we're trying to understand the significance of these results. I was part of the 302 study, and I don't remember having that issue. So it's going to be interesting to go back and try to see how that was managed in the trial. I guess you both have experience with the combination of EV and Pembro in the first line setting and later lines. Do you find that this combination is as toxic, more toxic, easier to give? What are the clinical challenges that you see if we start applying this combination in our practice tomorrow morning?
I haven't had a ton of experience. I mean, it's just basically from the trial setting. The main toxicity that I've seen in my patients were neuropathy. And usually I've managed that with a combination of dose holding or dose breaks and dose reductions. But it's something that it's important that we talk to our patients about, because it's how you ask the question is important as well, right? Because it might easily like, oh, it's fine, you know, but if you actually ask, are you having trouble doing specific activities? Are you having, you know, different things? I think it's important that we really check on that closely. I didn't have a lot of problems with rash with my patients on the combination, but EV alone, I've seen that patients can have rash. And for that, I'm often using something like low dose steroids, like a low prednisone or something like that is often helpful. But in general, fairly well tolerated medications.
Bernie, do you have?
My experience as well is predominantly with single agent EV in the longer term. And I think the neuropathy longer term is a toxicity that we will have to learn more about in the patients who are followed for longer on the EV-302 study. Because, you know, initially when EV Pembro came along, everybody was looking at, boy, we're going to get away from nasty chemotherapy. But I think the toxicities of these agents are also a significant consideration. And, you know, I think with more experience and more early education of patients on what to look out for and early intervention, these are manageable toxicities from what I've seen, but new toxicities nonetheless.
Well, there are many different centers in this trial, and probably most investigators got to treat two or three on the average with this combination. So it was a new regimen for everyone. And we've learned from that experience. And I guess with better clinical experience with this combination, we'll definitely get better at the management. I think involving neurology to some extent, we don't necessarily need these consultants to see every patient, but just to have their sense of what they would like us to do about these types of neuropathies, talking about rash management in the context of using immunotherapy and EV. I've had some experience with that, and talking to dermatologists, they recognize immunotherapy-related rash, and they can distinguish that from EV-related rash. So having experienced dermatologists or potentially artificial intelligence to guide us to recognize these rashes could be something of the future. Any other toxicities that you'd be considering?
I think the other one that we always have to be aware of is diabetes. We've seen that even with the single agent, and it's something that can kind of be a bit insidious, but like we do sort of keep an eye on blood work and everything. So that's one. I think the other thing, and having done the phase one study of the single agent several years ago, we did see responses at even slightly lower dose levels. So 1.25 is a recommended dose, but at the 1 milligram dosing, we did see responses. And I think that's important to keep in mind, because if a patient is having toxicity, you can say, well, let's do a dose reduction. There's still evidence of, you know, activity. And I think that opens the door a little bit, because there's sometimes a bit of underreporting where patients don't tell you because they're afraid you're going to stop the drug. So that's sort of an in-between thing. And I think many of us in academic centers have had some experience with the drugs, but there may be more people who weren't using these drugs before that now start using the drugs. So they really need to be well-equipped in terms of how to manage toxicity.
So this presentation of EV-302 was commented by Andrea Apollo, and she actually suggested that she wouldn't necessarily treat diabetic patients with this combination. Do you agree with that? Or is there a way to mitigate, you know, the diabetic experience for patients to be able to go on that regimen?
I mean, I would say uncontrolled diabetic. If I have somebody whose diabetes is well managed, that wouldn't necessarily keep me from using this combination. I personally haven't run into a lot of trouble with hyperglycemia that wasn't, you know, easily managed. But I have to learn, like everybody else, this is a new combination. The other comment I would say around toxicities, there are toxicities that maybe are not as common for either agent, but are there for both. And if they happen, you have to think about which one is causing it. And the big one for me is diarrhea. I've had one patient on this combination who had a severe event with diarrhea, and sorting out which of the causes it was difficult.
Yeah, for sure. So that's part of the equation. And I'm still have different things to learn about this presentation and these results. We've seen that the grade three events in terms of toxicity happened in 56% of patients. But when you add the different toxicities that were presented, it adds up to 30-ish percent. Mm-hmm. So it's probably quite varied. So that's probably the explanation is that there are many grade 3 events that happen in very rare patients. So we'll have to get used to managing very varied side effects that can happen with that regimen. So it's challenging, but at the same time, when you see the magnitude of the results that we're getting, it's certainly something very attractive for us and our patients.
I think it'll also be interesting if there's a correlation between these toxicities and response, and that would be something to, you know, for future studies to explore, you know, because there's nectin expression beyond just in the tumor, there's expression in the skin. And so if you have more toxicity, potentially you're hitting the target better and maybe you're getting a better response. So I think there'll be a number of subsequent studies to come, as well as how many people had dose reductions, how many people had, you know, dose holidays. I think all of that information will come out. But despite all of that, we still saw a very significant efficacy benefit.
So the urothelial cancer field is moving very fast, and we've started using adjuvant immunotherapy. So will that change your algorithm based on the use of adjuvant or neoadjuvant therapies in the future? Do you think we have to incorporate the use of neoadjuvant chemotherapy or adjuvant immunotherapy? And how does that reflect what we do in the first-line setting for patients who recur?
I mean, that's a fantastic question. I think in my practice, I aim to give neoadjuvant chemotherapy to anybody who's eligible. And interestingly, we presented results from the PEPMUSE study showing use of neoadjuvant chemotherapy is about 60%, which is actually very, very encouraging. I think, as you know, Ontarians or whatever, Canada is probably doing the same thing. That's great. So my paradigm is usually neoadjuvant chemotherapy, followed by surgery, followed by adjuvant nivolumab for patients with high-risk disease who sort of meet criteria for CheckMate 274. Now, where we go to next is, I think, going to be dictated in part by when the metastatic disease appears relative to the end of nivolumab. So if someone's on nivolumab and then they progress within a year, then I may be inclined to go to single agent enfortumab following that treatment paradigm. However, if it's over a year, then I might consider going to EV plus Pembro. But this is an area where we really don't have data and we really need trials, you know, really discussing this issue of retreatment. Does that have any benefit? Yes or no?
So do you think, Kala, that there's actually synergy between Pembro and EV, making it interesting to rechallenge patients after adjuvant nivolumab?
So tricky question. So yes, I believe that there's synergy between EV plus Pembro. Do I believe that there's benefit to retreating? I don't know. And that's where I feel like I need some space and time between using single agent Nevo and EV Pembro in combination. I don't know what the delta is in terms of giving EV Pembro in someone who's had prior IO.
So Bernie, I saw you smiling. Did you want to add anything about that?
I got most of our conversation due to technical issues. I apologize, but I fully agree. It's a very interesting situation, and one that by the time we figure it out, we may have readouts from the B15 study and everything changes again. But I agree it's going to be a difficult situation.
Well, the next logical step is to move EV Pembro forward in the new adjuvant space, and that is going to change things as well if we get to that. So we'll have to be creative on how to treat patients in the metastatic field if patients are benefiting in the new adjuvant or adjuvant space, or maybe there won't be enough metastatic patients left around for us to do these trials. So that would be a nice wish for the future.
Yeah, and then maybe more people will get to keep their bladders too. Just a little plug for bladder sparing. If we get better systemic treatments, then maybe more patients can be converted into being able to keep their bladder, you know, with something like concurrent chemo radiation or something.
Well, that's a very interesting point. And we're developing technologies to measure in the urine the presence of residual cancer. And that's an exciting technology that is certainly going to help us in that regard.
Definitely. In the urine and certainly in the blood, there's a lot of interesting data coming out with ctDNA. We know from the adjuvant study in VIGOR-10, patients who are ctDNA positive had worse prognosis but better response with the atezolizumab. So that's led to two further trials in VIGOR-11 and the modern study. both now trying to use ctDNA to help us to, you know, figure out how to treat patients. So I think it'll be really an interesting time to come.
So coming back to the real life management of these patients, are there any patients where you actually wouldn't consider EV pembro at all in the metastatic setting?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think the data is really strong and very exciting. I think you can think about performance status, but you have to figure out, is the drop in performance status due to the disease or is it due to comorbidities? Because if it's due to the disease, giving them a very effective regimen like EV pembro, you may actually improve their performance status. But if it's due to comorbidities, and let's say they live really far away and they can't come in for weekly treatment, you might think about giving something like Gemcis in that situation. But a lot of patients, I think I would be inclined based on this data to offer EV pembro once and hopefully soon we have it available.
Well, Bernie alluded to the fact that in the study, many patients didn't have access to avelumab in the control arm. So the actual control in the study for many patients was platinum combined with gemcitabine without avelumab. So a lot of my colleagues that aren't experienced with EV pembro just might use this point to drive some sort of inertia and think that, you know, using combination chemo with avelumab could be just as good as EV pembro. So what would be your arguments, Bernie, to address that point?
Yeah, I mean, I disagree. And I was trying to have that argument before the presentation. But after the presentation, I mean, 30% of patients receiving avelumab is actually quite a good number. Again, we'll have to see how that data matures. But if, you know, you can't do across trial comparisons because they're very different populations, right? Avelumab was only the responders. And you could have made the argument that 29 months from start of chemo survival in avelumab is comparable to 31 months on EV-302. But again, EV-302 was all comers. And if you look at the hazard ratio and how the control arm did and everything else, I do think that this looks more efficacious than simply treating the responders with avelumab, which at the moment still is what we have. But it's I do think that this is practice changing in that sense.
I fully agree, Bernie. And I think with time, we may get more mature results of the study, and we might be able to have some statistical evaluation of how the interaction with avelumab can potentially change the results. But to change the results to the point that we've seen is probably unattainable by any combination that we know besides this one so far. So now that we're going to adopt this combination for most patients in the first line setting, what is left for patients that recur? So patients have used EV for most of their first line experience. They've been able to tolerate pembrolizumab. And let's just say that at 14 months, there's progression while on both agents. What would be your next choice of therapy,
Ella? So I think the choice would be a couple choices. So if they're cisplatin eligible, I use a creatinine cutoff of 50. You could consider going to gem-cis. If not, you could think of gem-carbo. Or if you have FGFR testing that shows they have a FGFR 2-3 alteration, you could think of something like erdafitinib. Obviously, clinical trial comes in wherever possible. I think the open question is whether or not you can give or should give maintenance of avelumab, right? Again, it's the retreatment question coming back. If they've progressed on EV pembro, if they've had disease progression on EV pembro, is it likely that they're going to gain benefit from the avelumab?
So there's plenty of data for those who weren't at ESMO about the use of erdafitinib in the first, second, or third line setting. So we have some data now to really help us decide which patients should get erdafitinib. And I guess the default strategy is to use chemo, which is still an effective combination. I would expect chemotherapy to be useful after EV pembro, but we don't have data for that. So that'd be nice to obtain this kind of data in a real world experience type study.
Yeah, I would add to that, there is now some equipoise of what is the best second line therapy, right? So you could argue that the data for something like gem-cis is as after EV pembro is as good as anything else because there isn't any. We know it's an active combination, but we don't know how active in that setting. So what if one of the other agents, like, say, sacituzumab govitecan, comes out with the TROPiCS-04 study having a survival benefit over chemotherapy? Does that become now a second-line option? Is, for me, this really, we are now in the world of we should be doing a lot more trials right now, even combination sort of discovery sort of trials to figure out what to use as our next second line to compare to the standard of chemotherapy, if that is the standard.
Yeah, I completely agree. There's a few things that are also coming down, a few other ADCs targeting HER2, for example. The question for me that's starting to evolve is in terms of if you have drugs with similar payloads, are they resistant, cross-resistant? How does that play out, right? If the patient's got an EV up front, down the line, does it make sense to give them an HER2-targeted ADC that also targets the MMAE? So I think those are some of the interesting questions coming up. We've also seen data on double antibody drug conjugates, so EV plus SG. How does that play out? Some of the response rates there are reasonably good as well. Again, early, early days, but I think we're trying to figure out what's the best approach.
So when I started medical school, the overall survival for metastatic urothelial cancer patients was less than a year. And we've been presented results that show that now patients can expect, on average, 31 months. So we'll see a lot of patients that are going to be in our clinics for a long time, and hopefully without toxicity and with an excellent quality of life. So it's definitely a new era for urothelial cancer treatment. Many other bladder cancer patients are underrepresented in these trials, the adenocarcinomas, the squamous, so we need to keep on working to find solutions for these patients. But it's definitely exciting going back to our clinic and try to get this combination approved for our Canadian patients. So I guess we've come to the closing point of this discussion. It's been really interesting to discuss this, and especially interesting to see Tom Powles present this data with all the excitement in the room when these data were presented. So hopefully we can get our Canadian funders to pay this for our patients as soon as possible. So with that, I'll close and wish you a good rest of your day.